Interest, however, was starting to flag somewhat all round, and the others got on to talking about accidents at sea, ships lost in a fog, collisions with icebergs, all that sort of thing. Ship Ahoy, of course, had his own say to say. He had doubled the Cape a few odd times, and weathered a monsoon, a kind of wind, in the China Seas, and through all those perils of the deep, there was one thing, he declared, stood to him, or words to that effect, a pious medal he had that saved him. So then, after that, they drifted on to the wreck of Daunt's Rock, wreck of that ill-fated Norwegian bark. Nobody could think of her name for the moment, till the jarvey, who had really quite a look of Henry Campbell, remembered it. Palme, on Booterstown Strand. That was the talk of the town that year. Albert William Quill wrote a fine piece of original verse of distinctive merit on the topic for the Irish Times. Breakers running over her, and crowds on the shore in commotion, petrified with horror. Then someone said something about the case of the SS Lady Cairns of Swansea, run into by the Mona, which was on an opposite tack, in rather muggyish weather, and lost with all hands on deck. No aid was given. Her master, the Mona's, said he was afraid his collision bulkhead would give way. She had no water, it appeared, in her hold. At this stage, an incident happened. It having become necessary for him to unfurl a reef, the sailor vacated his seat.
"Let me cross your bows, mate,"
he said to his neighbour, who was just gently dropping off into a peaceful doze. He made tracks heavily, slowly, with a dumpy sort of a gait, to the door, stepped heavily down the one step there was out of the shelter, and bore due left. While he was in the act of getting his bearings, Mr. Bloom, who noticed when he stood up that he had two flasks of presumably ship's rum sticking one out of each pocket for the private consumption of his burning interior, saw him produce a bottle and uncork it, or unscrew, and applying its nozzle to his lips, take a good old delectable swig out of it with a gurgling noise. The irrepressible Bloom, who also had a shrewd suspicion that the old stager went out on a manoeuvre after the counter-attraction in the shape of a female, who, however, had disappeared to all intents and purposes, could, by straining, just perceive him, when duly refreshed by his rum-puncheon exploit, gazing up at the piers and girders of the loop line, rather out of his depth, as of course it was all radically altered since his last visit, and greatly improved. Some person or persons invisible directed him to the male urinal erected by the cleansing committee all over the place for the purpose, but after a brief space of time, during which silence reigned supreme, the sailor, evidently giving it a wide berth, eased himself close at hand, the noise of his bilge water some little time subsequently splashing on the ground, where it apparently woke a horse of the cab rank. A hoof scooped anyway for new foothold after sleep, and harness jingled. Slightly disturbed in his sentry-box by the brazier of live coke, the watcher of the corporation, who, though now broken down and fast breaking up, was none other in stern reality than the Gumley aforesaid, now practically on the parish rates, given the temporary job by Pat Tobin in all human probability, from dictates of humanity, knowing him before, shifted about and shuffled in his box before composing his limbs again in the arms of Morpheus. A truly amazing piece of hard times in its most virulent form on a fellow most respectably connected and familiarized with decent home comfort all his life, who came in for a cool £100 a year at one time, which, of course, the double-barreled ass proceeded to make general ducks and drakes of. And there he was at the end of his tether, after having often painted the town tolerably pink, without a beggarly stiver. He drank, needless to be told, and it pointed only once more a moral, when he might quite easily be in a large way of business, if, a big if, however, he had contrived to cure himself of his particular partiality. All, meantime, were loudly lamenting the falling off in Irish shipping, coastwise and foreign as well, which was all part and parcel of the same thing. A Palgrave Murphy boat was put off the ways at Alexandra Basin, the only launch that year. Right enough the harbours were there, only no ships ever called.
There were wrecks and wrecks,
the keeper said, who was evidently au fait. What he wanted to ascertain was why that ship ran bang against the only rock in Galway Bay when the Galway Harbour scheme was mooted by a Mr. Worthington or some name like that, eh? Ask her captain, he advised them, how much palm oil the British government gave him for that day's work. Captain John Lever of the Lever line.
Am I right, Skipper?
He queried of the sailor, now returning after his private potation and the rest of his exertions. That worthy, picking up the scent of the fag end of the song or words, growled in would-be music, but with great vim, some kind of shanty or other in seconds or thirds. Mr. Bloom's sharp ears heard him then expectorate the plug, probably, which it was, so that he must have lodged it for the time being in his fist while he did the drinking and making water jobs, and found it a bit sour after the liquid fire in question. Anyhow, in he rolled after his successful libation, cum potation, introducing an atmosphere of drink into the soiree, boisterously trolling like a veritable son of a sea cook.
The biscuits was as hard as brass, and the beef as salt as Lot's wife's arse. Oh, Johnny Lever, Johnny Lever, oh!
After which effusion, the redoubtable specimen duly arrived on the scene, and regaining his seat, he sank rather than sat heavily on the form provided. Skin the Goat, assuming he was he, evidently with an axe to grind, was airing his grievances in a forcible, feeble philippic anent the natural resources of Ireland, or something of that sort, which he described in his lengthy dissertation as the richest country bar none on the face of God's earth, far and away superior to England, with coal in large quantities, 6 million pounds worth of pork exported every year, 10 millions between butter and eggs, and all the riches drained out of it by England, levying taxes on the poor people that paid through the nose always, and gobbling up the best meat in the market, and a lot more surplus steam in the same vein. Their conversation accordingly became general, and all agreed that that was a fact. You could grow any mortal thing in Irish soil, he stated, and there was Colonel Everard down there in Cavan growing tobacco. Where would you find anywhere the like of Irish bacon? But a day of reckoning, he stated crescendo with no uncertain voice, thoroughly monopolizing all the conversation, was in store for mighty England, despite her power of pelf, on account of her crimes. There would be a fall, and the greatest fall in history. The Germans and the Japs were going to have their little look in, he affirmed. The Boers were the beginning of the end. Brummagem England was toppling already, and her downfall would be Ireland, her Achilles heel, which he explained to them about the vulnerable point of Achilles, the Greek hero, a point his auditors at once seized as he completely gripped their attention by showing the tendon referred to on his boot. His advice to every Irishman was, stay in the land of your birth and work for Ireland and live for Ireland. Ireland, Parnell said, could not spare a single one of her sons. Silence all round marked the termination of his finale. The impervious navigator heard these lurid tidings undismayed.
Take a bit of doing, boss,
retaliated that rough diamond, palpably a bit peeved in response to the foregoing truism. To which cold douche, referring to downfall and so on, the keeper concurred, but nevertheless held to his main view.
Who's the best troops in the army?
The grizzled old veteran irately interrogated.
And the best jumpers and racers, and the best admirals and generals we've got, tell me that.
The Irish will choose,
retorted the cabby like Campbell, facial blemishes apart.
That's right,
the old tarpaulin corroborated.
The Irish Catholic peasant, he's the backbone of our empire. You know Jem Mullins?
While allowing him his individual opinions, as every man, the keeper added he cared nothing for any empire, ours or his, and considered no Irishman worthy of his salt that served it. Then they began to have a few irascible words, when it waxed hotter, both, needless to say, appealing to the listeners who followed the passage of arms with interest, so long as they didn't indulge in recriminations and come to blows. From inside information extending over a series of years, Mr. Bloom was rather inclined to pooh-pooh the suggestion as egregious balderdash, for, pending that consummation devoutly to be, or not to be wished for, he was fully cognizant of the fact that their neighbours across the Channel, unless they were much bigger fools than he took them for, rather concealed their strength than the opposite. It was quite on a par with the quixotic idea in certain quarters that in 100 million years the coal seam of the sister island would be played out, and if, as time went on, that turned out to be how the cat jumped, all he could personally say on the matter was that, as a host of contingencies equally relevant to the issue might occur ere then, it was highly advisable in the interim to try to make the most of both countries, even though poles apart. Another little interesting point, the amours of whores and chummies, to put it in common parlance, reminded him Irish soldiers had as often fought for England as against her, more so in fact. And now why? So the scene between the pair of them, the licensee of the place, rumoured to be or have been Fitzharris, the famous invincible, and the other, obviously bogus, reminded him forcibly as being on all fours with the confidence trick, supposing, that is, it was prearranged, as the looker-on, a student of the human soul, if anything, the others seeing least of the game. And as for the lessee or keeper, who probably wasn't the other person at all, he, Bloom, couldn't help feeling, and most properly, it was better to give people like that the go-by, unless you were a blithering idiot altogether, and refused to have anything to do with them, as a golden rule in private life and a felon setting. There always being the off chance of a Danny man coming forward and turning Queen's evidence, or King's now, like Dennis or Peter Carey, an idea he utterly repudiated. Quite apart from that, he disliked those careers of wrongdoing and crime on principle. Yet, though such criminal propensities had never been an inmate of his bosom in any shape or form, he certainly did feel, and no denying it, while inwardly remaining what he was, a certain kind of admiration for a man who had actually brandished a knife, cold steel, with the courage of his political convictions, though personally he would never be a party to any such thing, off the same bat as those love vendettas of the South, have her or swing for her, when the husband, frequently after some words passed between the two concerning her relations with the other lucky mortal, the man having had the pair watched, inflicted fatal injuries on his adored one as a result of an alternative post-nuptial liaison by plunging his knife into her, until it just struck him that Fitz, nicknamed Skin the Goat, merely drove the car for the actual perpetrators of the outrage, and so was not, if he was reliably informed, actually party to the ambush, which, in point of fact, was the plea some legal luminary saved his skin on. In any case, that was very ancient history by now. And as for our friend, the pseudo-Skindy, etc., he had transparently outlived his welcome. He ought to have either died naturally or on the scaffold high. Like actresses, always farewell, positively last performance, then come up smiling again. Generous to a fault, of course, temperamental, no economizing, or any idea of the sort, always snapping at the bone for the shadow. So, similarly, he had a very shrewd suspicion that Mr. Johnny Lever got rid of some LSD in the course of his perambulations round the docks, in the congenial atmosphere of the Old Ireland Tavern, come back to Erin, and so on. Then, as for the others, he had heard not so long before the same identical lingo, as he told Stephen how he simply but effectually silenced the offender.
He took umbrage at something or other.
That much injured, but on the whole even-tempered person declared.
I let slip. He called me a Jew, and in a heated fashion, offensively. So I, without deviating from plain facts in the least, told him his God, I mean Christ, was a Jew too, and all his family, like me, though in reality I'm not. That was one for him. A soft answer turns away wrath. He hadn't a word to say for himself, as everyone saw. Am I not right?
He turned a long, you are wrong, gaze on Stephen of timorous, dark pride at the soft impeachment, with a glance also of entreaty, for he seemed to glean in a kind of way that it wasn't all exactly...
Ex quibus,
Stephen mumbled in a noncommittal accent, their two or four eyes conversing.
Christus or Bloom, his name is, or after all any other, secundum carnem.
Of course,
Mr. Bloom proceeded to stipulate.
You must look at both sides of the question. It is hard to lay down any hard and fast rules as to right and wrong, but room for improvement all round there certainly is. Though every country, they say, our own distressful included, has the government it deserves. But with a little goodwill all round. It's all very fine to boast of mutual superiority, but what about mutual equality? I resent violence or intolerance in any shape or form. It never reaches anything or stops anything. A revolution must come on the due instalments plan. It is a patent absurdity on the face of it to hate people because they live round the corner and speak another vernacular, so to speak.
Memorable bloody bridge battle and 7 minutes' war,
Stephen assented.
Between Skinner's Alley and Ormond Market.
Yes.
Mr. Bloom thoroughly agreed, entirely endorsing the remark. That was overwhelmingly right, and the whole world was overwhelmingly full of that sort of thing.
You just took the words out of my mouth,
he said.
A hocus-pocus of conflicting evidence that, candidly, you couldn't remotely...
All those wretched quarrels, in his humble opinion, stirring up bad blood, bump of combativeness or gland of some kind, erroneously supposed to be about a punctilio of honour and a flag, were very largely a question of the money question, which was at the back of everything. Greed and jealousy, people never knowing when to stop.
They accuse,
remarked he audibly. He turned away from the others, who probably... and spoke nearer to, so as the others... In case they...
Jews,
he softly imparted in an aside in Stephen's ear.
Are accused of ruining. Not a vestige of truth in it, I can safely say. History, would you be surprised to learn, proves up to the hilt Spain decayed when the Inquisition hounded the Jews out, and England prospered when Cromwell, an uncommonly able ruffian who in other respects has much to answer for, imported them. Why? Because they are practical and are proved to be so. I don't want to indulge in any, because you know the standard works on the subject, and then, orthodox as you are. But in the economic, not touching religion domain, the priest spells poverty. Spain, again, you saw in the war, compared with go-ahead America. Turks, it's in the dogma. Because if they didn't believe they'd go straight to heaven when they die, they'd try to live better. At least, so I think. That's the juggle on which the PPs raise the wind on false pretenses. I'm...
He resumed with dramatic force.
As good an Irishman as that rude person I told you about at the outset, and I want to see everyone, all creeds and classes pro rata, having a comfortable, tidy-sized income, in no niggard fashion either, something in the neighbourhood of £300 per annum. That's the vital issue at stake, and it's feasible and would be provocative of friendlier intercourse between man and man. At least, that's my idea for what it's worth. I call that patriotism. You be patria, as we learned a small smattering of in our classical day in Alma Mater, Vita Bene, where you can live well, the sense is, if you work.
Over his untastable apology for a cup of coffee, listening to this synopsis of things in general, Stephen stared at nothing in particular. He could hear, of course, all kinds of words changing colour, like those crabs about Ringsend in the morning, burrowing quickly into all colours of different sorts of the same sand, where they had a home somewhere beneath, or seemed to. Then he looked up and saw the eyes that said, or didn't say the words, the voice he heard said, "If you work."
"Count me out,"
he managed to remark, meaning to work. The eyes were surprised at this observation, because as he, the person who owned them, pro tem, observed, or rather his voice speaking did, all must work, have to, together.
"I mean, of course,"
the other hastened to affirm,
"work in the widest possible sense. Also literary labour, not merely for the kudos of the thing. Writing for the newspapers, which is the readiest channel nowadays. That's work, too. Important work. After all, from the little I know of you, after all the money expended on your education, you are entitled to recoup yourself and command your price. You have every bit as much right to live by your pen in pursuit of your philosophy as the peasant has. What? You both belong to Ireland. The brain and the brawn, each is equally important."
"You suspect,"
Stephen retorted with a sort of a half-laugh,
"that I may be important because I belong to the Faubourg St. Patrice, called Ireland for short."
"I would go a step further,"
Mr. Bloom insinuated.
"But I suspect,"
Stephen interrupted,
"that Ireland must be important because it belongs to me."
"What belongs?"
queried Mr. Bloom, bending, fancying he was perhaps under some misapprehension.
"Excuse me. Unfortunately, I didn't catch the latter portion. What was it you..."
Stephen, patently cross-tempered, repeated, and shoved aside his mug of coffee, or whatever you like to call it, none too politely, adding,
"We can't change the country. Let us change the subject."
At this pertinent suggestion, Mr. Bloom, to change the subject, looked down, but in a quandary, as he couldn't tell exactly what construction to put on belongs to, which sounded rather a far cry. The rebuke of some kind was clearer than the other part. Needless to say, the fumes of his recent orgy spoke then with some asperity in a curious, bitter way, foreign to his sober state. Probably the home life, to which Mr. Bloom attached the utmost importance, had not been all that was needful, or he hadn't been familiarized with the right sort of people. With a touch of fear for the young man beside him, whom he furtively scrutinized with an air of some consternation, remembering he had just come back from Paris, the eyes more especially reminding him forcibly of father and sister, failing to throw much light on the subject, however, he brought to mind instances of cultured fellows that promised so brilliantly, nipped in the bud of premature decay, and nobody to blame but themselves. For instance, there was the case of O'Callaghan, for one, the half-crazy faddist, respectably connected, though of inadequate means, with his mad vagaries, among whose other gay doings, when rotto, and making himself a nuisance to everybody all round, he was in the habit of ostentatiously sporting in public a suit of brown paper, a fact. And then the usual denouement after the fun had gone on fast and furious. He got landed into hot water and had to be spirited away by a few friends, after a strong hint to a blind horse from John Mallon of Lower Castle Yard, so as not to be made amenable under Section 2 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, certain names of those subpoenaed being handed in but not divulged, for reasons which will occur to anyone with a pick of brains. Briefly, putting two and two together, 616, which he pointedly turned a deaf ear to, Antonio and so forth, jockeys and aesthetes, and the tattoo, which was all the go in the 70s or thereabouts, even in the House of Lords, because early in life the occupant of the throne, then heir apparent, the other members of the upper ten and other high personages simply following in the footsteps of the head of the state, he reflected about the errors of notorieties and crowned heads running counter to morality, such as the Cornwall case a number of years before, under their veneer, in a way scarcely intended by nature, a thing good Mrs. Grundy, as the law stands, was terribly down on, though not for the reason they thought they were, probably, whatever it was, except women chiefly, who were always fiddling more or less at one another, it being largely a matter of dress and all the rest of it. Ladies who like distinctive underclothing should, and every well-tailored man must, try to make the gap wider between them by innuendo, and give more of a genuine fillip to acts of impropriety between the two. She unbuttoned his, and then he untied her. Mind a pin. Whereas savages in the Cannibal Islands, say, at 90 degrees in the shade, not carrying a continental. However, reverting to the original, there were, on the other hand, others who had forced their way to the top from the lowest rung by the aid of their bootstraps. Sheer force of natural genius, that. With brains, sir. For which, and further reasons, he felt it was interest and duty even to wait on and profit by the unlooked-for occasion, though why he could not exactly tell, being, as it was, already several shillings to the bad, having, in fact, let himself in for it. Still, to cultivate the acquaintance of someone of no uncommon calibre who could provide food for reflection would amply repay any small intellectual stimulation, as such was, he felt, from time to time a first-rate tonic for the mind, added to which was the coincidence of meeting, discussion, dance, row, old salt, of the here-today and gone-tomorrow type, night loafers, the whole galaxy of events, all went to make up a miniature cameo of the world we live in, especially as the lives of the submerged tenth, viz. Coal miners, divers, scavengers, etc., were very much under the microscope lately. To improve the shining hour, he wondered whether he might meet with anything approaching the same luck as Mr. Philip Beaufoy, if taken down in writing. Suppose he were to pen something out of the common groove, as he fully intended doing, at the rate of 1 guinea per column. My experiences, let us say, in a cabman's shelter. The pink edition, extra sporting of the Telegraph, telegraphic lie, lay, as luck would have it, beside his elbow, and as he was just puzzling again, far from satisfied, over a country belonging to him, and the preceding rebus, the vessel came from Bridgewater, and the postcard was addressed to A. Boudin, find the captain's age, his eyes went aimlessly over the respective captions which came under his special province, the all-embracing Give Us This Day Our Daily Press. First he got a bit of a start, but it turned out to be only something about somebody named H. Du Bois, agent for typewriters or something like that. Great Battle, Tokyo. Lovemaking in Irish, £200 damages. Gordon Bennett, Emigration Swindle. Letter from His Grace William Cross. Ascot, Throwaway, recalls Derby of 92 when Captain Marshall's dark horse Sir Hugo captured the blue ribbon at long odds. New York disaster, 1,000 lives lost. Foot and mouth. Funeral of the late Mr. Patrick Dignam. So to change the subject, he read about Dignam, R.I.P., which he reflected was anything but a gay send-off.
This morning, Hines put it in, of course, the remains of the late Mr. Patrick Dignam were removed from his residence, number 9, Newbridge Avenue, Sandymount, for interment in Glasnevin. The deceased gentleman was a most popular and genial personality in city life, and his demise after a brief illness came as a great shock to citizens of all classes, by whom he is deeply regretted. The obsequies at which many friends of the deceased were present were carried out, certainly Hines wrote it, with a nudge from Corney, by Messrs. H. J. O'Neill and Son, 164 North Strand Road. The mourners included Patrick Dignam's son, Bernard Corrigan, brother-in-law, John Henry Menton, solicitor, Martin Cunningham, John Power, he don def 1/8 adore Dorador Duradora, must be where he called Monks the Day Father about Keys Ad. Thomas Kernan, Simon Dedalus, Stephen Dedalus, B.A., Edward J. Lambert, Cornelius Kelleher, Joseph McSee, Hines, L. Boom, C.P. McCoy, Mackintosh and several others.
Nettled not a little by L. Boom, as it incorrectly stated, and the line of bitch type, but tickled to death simultaneously by C.P. McCoy and Stephen Dedalus, B.A., who were conspicuous, needless to say, by their total absence, to say nothing of Mackintosh, L. Boom pointed it out to his companion, B.A., engaged in stifling another yawn, half-nervousness, not forgetting the usual crop of nonsensical howlers of misprints.
"Is that first epistle to the Hebrews?"
he asked, as soon as his bottom jaw would let him.
"In. Text. Open thy mouth and put thy foot in it."
"It is, really,"
Mr. Bloom said, though first he fancied he alluded to the Archbishop, till he added about foot and mouth, with which there could be no possible connection. Overjoyed to set his mind at rest, and a bit flabbergasted at Miles Crawford's, after all, managing the thing there. While the other was reading it on page 2, Boom, to give him for the nonce his new misnomer, whiled away a few odd leisure moments in fits and starts with the account of the third event at Ascot on page 3, his side. Value 1,000 sovs, with 3,000 sovs in specie added for entire colts and fillies. Mr. F. Alexander's throwaway, B.H., by right away, 5 years, 9 stone, 4 pounds, Trail, W. Lane, 1. Lord Howard de Walden's Dinfandel, M. Cannon, 2. Mr. W. Bass's Scepter, 3. Betting 5-4 on Zinfandel, 20-1, throwaway, off. Throwaway and Zinfandel stood close order. It was anybody's race. Then the rank outsider drew to the fore, got long lead, beating Lord Howard de Walden's Chestnut Colt and Mr. W. Bass's Bay Filly Scepter on a 2.5 mile course. Winner trained by Brain, so that Lenehan's version of the business was all pure bunkum, secured the verdict cleverly by a length. 1,000 sovs with 300 in specie. Also ran J. de Bremond's French horse Bantam Lions was anxiously inquiring after, not in yet, but expected any minute. Maximum the second. Different ways of bringing off a coup. Love-making damages. Though that half-baked Lions ran off at a tangent in his impetuosity to get left. Of course, gambling eminently lent itself to that sort of thing, though, as the event turned out, the poor fool hadn't much reason to congratulate himself on his pick, the forlorn hope. Guesswork it reduced itself to, eventually.
There was every indication they would arrive at that,
Mr. Bloom said.
Who?
The other, whose hand, by the way, was hurt, said. One morning you would open the paper, the cabman affirmed, and read, Return of Parnell. He bet them what they liked. A Dublin fusilier was in that shelter one night and said he saw him in South Africa. Pride, as was, killed him. He ought to have done away with himself, or lain low for a time after committee room number 15, until he was his old self again, with no one to point a finger at him. Then they would all to a man have gone down on their marrow bones to him to come back when he had recovered his senses. But dead he wasn't. Simply absconded somewhere. The coffin they brought over was full of stones. He changed his name to De Wet, the Boer General. He made a mistake to fight the priests, and so forth and so on. All the same, Bloom, properly so dubbed, was rather surprised at their memories, for in 9 cases out of 10 it was a case of tar barrels, and not singly, but in their thousands, and then complete oblivion, because it was 20-odd years. Highly unlikely, of course, there was even a shadow of truth in the stories, and even supposing he thought a return highly inadvisable, all things considered. Something evidently riled them in his death. Either he petered out too tamely of acute pneumonia, just when his various different political arrangements were nearing completion, or whether it transpired he owed his death to his having neglected to change his boots and clothes after a wetting, when a cold resulted, and failing to consult a specialist, he being confined to his room, till he eventually died of it, amid widespread regret, before a fortnight was at an end, or quite possibly they were distressed to find the job was taken out of their hands. Of course, nobody being acquainted with his movements even before, there was absolutely no clue as to his whereabouts, which were decidedly of the Alice, Where Art Thou order, even prior to his starting to go under several aliases, such as Fox and Stewart. So the remark which emanated from friend Cabby might be within the bounds of possibility. Naturally, then, it would prey on his mind as a born leader of men, which undoubtedly he was, and a commanding figure, a six-footer, or at any rate 5 feet 10 or 11 in his stockinged feet, whereas Messrs. So-and-so, who, though they weren't even a patch on the former man, ruled the roost after, their redeeming features were very few and far between. It certainly pointed a moral, the idol with feet of clay. And then 72 of his trusty henchmen rounding on him with mutual mudslinging. And the identical same with murderers. You had to come back. That haunting sense kind of drew you to show the understudy in the title role how to. He saw him once, on the auspicious occasion when they broke up the type in the insuppressible, or was it United Ireland, a privilege he keenly appreciated, and, in point of fact, handed him his silk hat when it was knocked off, and he said, "Thank you," excited, as he undoubtedly was, under his frigid expression, notwithstanding the little misadventure mentioned between the cup and the lip, what's spread in the bone. Still, as regards return, you were a lucky dog if they didn't set the terrier at you directly you got back. Then a lot of shilly-shally usually followed. Tom for and Dick and Harry against. And then, number one, you came up against the man in possession and had to produce your credentials, like the claimant in the Tichborne case, Roger Charles Tichborne. Bella was the boat's name, to the best of his recollection. He, the heir, went down in, as the evidence went to show. And there was a tattoo mark, too, in Indian ink. Lord Bellew, was it? As he might very easily have picked up the details from some pal on board ship, and then, when got up to tally with the description given, introduce himself with, "Excuse me, my name is so-and-so," or some such commonplace remark. A more prudent course, Mr. Bloom said to the not-over-effusive, in fact, like the distinguished personage under discussion beside him, would have been to sound the lie of the land first.
"That bitch, that English hoer did for him,"
the she-being proprietor commented.
"She put the first nail in his coffin."
"Fine lump of a woman all the same,"
the soi-disant town clerk, Henry Campbell, remarked.
"And plenty of her. I seen her picture in a barber's. Her husband was a captain or an officer."
"Aye,"
Skinned the Goat amusingly added.
"He was, and a cotton ball one."
This gratuitous contribution of a humorous character occasioned a fair amount of laughter among his entourage. As regards Bloom, he, without the faintest suspicion of a smile, merely gazed in the direction of the door and reflected upon the historic story which had aroused extraordinary interest at the time when the facts, to make matters worse, were made public with the usual affectionate letters that passed between them, full of sweet nothings. First, it was strictly platonic, till nature intervened, and an attachment sprang up between them, till bit by bit matters came to a climax, and the matter became the talk of the town, till the staggering blow came as a welcome intelligence to not a few evil-disposed, however, who were resolved upon encouraging his downfall, though the thing was public property all along, though not to anything like the sensational extent that it subsequently blossomed into. Since their names were coupled, though, since he was her declared favourite, where was the particular necessity to proclaim it to the rank and file from the housetops, the fact, namely, that he had shared her bedroom, which came out in the witness-box, on oath, when a thrill went through the packed court, literally electrifying everybody in the shape of witnesses, swearing to having witnessed him on such and such a particular date in the act of scrambling out of an upstairs apartment with the assistance of a ladder, in night apparel, having gained admittance in the same fashion, a fact that the weeklies, addicted to the lubric a little, simply coined shoals of money out of. Whereas the simple fact of the case was, it was simply a case of the husband not being up to the scratch, with nothing in common between them beyond the name, and then a real man arriving on the scene, strong to the verge of weakness, falling a victim to her siren charms, and forgetting home ties. The usual sequel, to bask in the loved one's smiles. The eternal question of the life connubial, needless to say, cropped up. Can real love, supposing there happens to be another chap in the case, exist between married folk? Though it was no concern of theirs, absolutely, if he regarded her with affection, carried away by a wave of folly. A magnificent specimen of manhood he was truly, augmented obviously by gifts of a high order, as compared with the other military supernumerary, that is, who was just the usual everyday farewell my gallant captain kind of an individual in the light dragoons, the 18th Hussars to be accurate, and inflammable, doubtless, the fallen leader, that is, not the other, in his own peculiar way, which she, of course, woman, quickly perceived as highly likely to carve his way to fame, which he almost bid fair to do, till the priests and ministers of the gospel as a whole, his erstwhile staunch adherents, and his beloved evicted tenants, for whom he had done yeoman service in the rural parts of the country, by taking up the cudgels on their behalf in a way that exceeded their most sanguine expectations, very effectually cooked his matrimonial goose, thereby heaping coals of fire on his head, much in the same way as the fabled ass's kick. Looking back now in a retrospective kind of arrangement, all seemed a kind of dream. And the coming back was the worst thing you ever did, because it went without saying you would feel out of place as things always moved with the times. Why, as he reflected, Irish Town Strand, a locality he had not been in for quite a number of years, looked different somehow since, as it happened, he went to reside on the north side. North or south, however, it was just the well-known case of hot passion, pure and simple, upsetting the apple cart with a vengeance, and just bore out the very thing he was saying, as she also was Spanish, or half so, types that wouldn't do things by halves, passionate abandon of the south, casting every shred of decency to the winds.
Just bears out what I was saying.
He, with glowing bosom, said to Stephen.
And if I don't greatly mistake, she was Spanish, too.
The King of Spain's daughter,
Stephen answered, adding something or other rather muddled about farewell and adieu to you Spanish onions, and the first land called the dead man, and from Ramhead to Scilly was so and so many.
Was she?
Bloom ejaculated, surprised, though not astonished by any means.
I never heard that rumour before. Possible. Especially there it was, as she lived there. So, Spain.
Carefully avoiding a book in his pocket, sweet sob, which reminded him, by the by, of that Caper Street library book out of date, he took out his pocket-book, and turning over the various contents rapidly, finally he...
Do you consider, by the by,
he said, thoughtfully selecting a faded photo which he laid on the table,
that a Spanish type?
Stephen, obviously addressed, looked down on the photo, showing a large-sized lady with her fleshy charms on evidence in an open fashion, as she was in the full bloom of womanhood, in evening dress cut ostentatiously low for the occasion, to give a liberal display of bosom, with more than vision of breasts, her full lips parted, and some perfect teeth, standing near, ostensibly with gravity, a piano, on the rest of which was In Old Madrid, a ballad, pretty in its way, which was then all the vogue. Her, the lady's eyes, dark, large, looked at Stephen, about to smile about something to be admired. Lafayette of Westmoreland Street, Dublin's premier photographic artist, being responsible for the aesthetic execution.
Mrs. Bloom, my wife, the prima donna, Madame Marion Tweedy,
Bloom indicated.
Taken a few years since, in about 96. Very like her then.
Beside the young man, he looked also at the photo of the lady, now his legal wife, who, he intimated, was the accomplished daughter of Major Brian Tweedy, and displayed at an early age remarkable proficiency as a singer, having even made her bow to the public when her years numbered barely sweet 16. As for the face, it was a speaking likeness in expression, but it did not do justice to her figure, which came in for a lot of notice, usually, and which did not come out to the best advantage in that get-up. She could, without difficulty, he said, have posed for the ensemble, not to dwell on certain opulent curves of the... He dwelt, being a bit of an artist in his spare time, on the female form in general, developmentally, because, as it so happened, no later than that afternoon he had seen those Grecian statues, perfectly developed as works of art, in the National Museum. Marble could give the original shoulders back, all the symmetry. All the rest, yes, Puritanism. It does, though, St. Joseph's sovereign. Whereas no photo could, because it simply wasn't art, in a word. The spirit moving him, he would much have liked to follow Jack Tar's good example and leave the likeness there for a very few minutes to speak for itself on the plea he, so that the other could drink in the beauty for himself, her stage presence being frankly a treat in itself which the camera could not at all do justice to. But it was scarcely professional etiquette, so, though it was a warm, pleasant sort of a night now, yet wonderfully cool for the season considering, for sunshine after storm, and he did feel a kind of need there and then to follow suit, like a kind of inward voice, and satisfy a possible need by moving emotion. Nevertheless, he sat tight, just viewing the slightly soiled photo, creased by opulent curves, none the worse for wear, however, and looked away thoughtfully with the intention of not further increasing the other's possible embarrassment, while gauging her symmetry of heaving embonpoint. In fact, the slight soiling was only an added charm, like the case of linen slightly soiled. Good as new, much better, in fact, with the starch out. Suppose she was gone when he... I looked for the lamp which she told me, came into his mind, but merely as a passing fancy of his, because he then recollected the morning, littered bed, etc., and the book about Ruby with Met Him Pike Hoses sick in it, which must have fell down sufficiently appropriately beside the domestic chamber pot, with apologies to Lindley Murray. The vicinity of the young man he certainly relished, educated, distingué, and impulsive into the bargain, far and away the pick of the bunch, though you wouldn't think he had it in him. Yet you would. Besides, he said the picture was handsome, which, say what you like, it was, though at the moment she was distinctly stouter. And why not? An awful lot of make-believe went on about that sort of thing, involving a lifelong slur, with the usual splash page of letterpress about the same old matrimonial tangle, alleging misconduct with professional golfer, or the newest stage favourite, instead of being honest and above board about the whole business. How they were fated to meet, and an attachment sprang up between the two, so that their names were coupled in the public eye, was told in court with letters containing the habitual, mushy and compromising expressions, leaving no loophole, to show that they openly cohabited two or three times a week at some well-known seaside hotel, and relations, when the thing ran its normal course, became in due course intimate. Then the decree, Nisi, and the king's proctor to show cause why, and he, failing to quash it, Nisi was made absolute. But as for that, the two misdemeanants, wrapped up as they largely were in one another, could safely afford to ignore it, as they very largely did, till the matter was put in the hands of a solicitor, who filed a petition for the party wronged in due course. He, Bloom, enjoyed the distinction of being close to Aaron's uncrowned king in the flesh, when the thing occurred in the historic fracas, when the fallen leaders, who notoriously stuck to his guns to the last drop, even when clothed in the mantle of adultery, leaders, trusty henchmen, to the number of 10 or 12, or possibly even more than that, penetrated into the printing works of the insuppressible, or no, it was United Ireland, a by no means, by the by, appropriate appellative, and broke up the type cases with hammers, or something like that, all on account of some scurrilous effusions from the facile pens of the O'Brienite scribes, at the usual mudslinging occupation, reflecting on the erstwhile tribune's private morals. Though palpably a radically altered man, he was still a commanding figure, though carelessly garbed, as usual, with that look of settled purpose which went a long way with the shilly-shalliers, till they discovered, to their vast discomfiture, that their idol had feet of clay, after placing him upon a pedestal, which she, however, was the first to perceive. As those were particularly hot times, in the general hullabaloo, Bloom sustained a minor injury from a nasty prod of some chap's elbow, in the crowd that, of course, congregated, lodging someplace about the pit of the stomach, fortunately not of a grave character. His hat, Parnell's, was inadvertently knocked off, and, as a matter of strict history, Bloom was the man who picked it up in the crush, after witnessing the occurrence, meaning to return it to him, and return it to him he did with the utmost celerity. Who, panting and hatless, and whose thoughts were miles away from his hat at the time, being a gentleman born with a stake in the country, he, as a matter of fact, having gone into it more for the kudos of the thing than anything else, what's bred in the bone, instilled into him in infancy at his mother's knee, in the shape of knowing what good form was, came out at once because he turned round to the donor and thanked him with perfect aplomb, saying, "Thank you, sir." Though in a very different tone of voice from the ornament of the legal profession whose headgear Bloom also set to rights earlier in the course of the day, history repeating itself with a difference. After the burial of a mutual friend, when they had left him alone in his glory, after the grim task of having committed his remains to the grave. On the other hand, what incensed him more inwardly was the blatant jokes of the cabmen and so on, who passed it all off as a jest, laughing immoderately, pretending to understand everything, the why and the wherefore, and in reality not knowing their own minds, it being a case for the two parties themselves, unless it ensued that the legitimate husband happened to be a party to it, owing to some anonymous letter from the usual boy, Jones, who happened to come across them at the crucial moment, in a loving position, locked in one another's arms, drawing attention to their illicit proceedings, and leading up to a domestic rumpus, and the erring fair one begging forgiveness of her lord and master upon her knees, and promising to sever the connection, and not receive his visits any more, if only the aggrieved husband would overlook the matter, and let bygones be bygones, with tears in her eyes, though possibly with her tongue in her fair cheek at the same time, as quite possibly there were several others. He personally, being of a sceptical bias, believed, and didn't make the smallest bones about saying so either, that man, or men in the plural, were always hanging around on the waiting list about a lady, even supposing she was the best wife in the world, and they got on fairly well together, for the sake of argument, when, neglecting her duties, she chose to be tired of wedded life, and was on for a little flutter in polite debauchery, to press their attentions on her with improper intent, the upshot being that her affections centred on another, the cause of many liaisons between still attractive married women getting on for fair and forty, and younger men, no doubt as several famous cases of feminine infatuation proved up to the hilt. It was a thousand pities a young fellow, blessed with an allowance of brains, as his neighbour obviously was, should waste his valuable time with profligate women, who might present him with a nice dose to last him his lifetime. In the nature of single blessedness, he would one day take unto himself a wife, when Miss Wright came on the scene. But in the interim, ladies' society was a conditio sine qua non, though he had the gravest possible doubts, not that he wanted in the smallest to pump Stephen about Miss Ferguson, who was very possibly the particular lodestar who brought him down to Irish Town so early in the morning, as to whether he would find much satisfaction basking in the boy and girl courtship idea, and the company of smirking misses without a penny to their names, bi or tri-weekly, with the orthodox preliminary canter of compliment paying and walking out, leading up to fond lovers' ways and flowers and chocks. To think of him house and homeless, rooked by some landlady worse than any stepmother, was really too bad at his age. The queer things he popped out suddenly with attracted the elder man, who was several years the other senior, or like his father. But something substantial he certainly ought to eat, were it only an egg flip made on unadulterated maternal nutriment, or failing that, the homely Humpty Dumpty boiled.
"At what o'clock did you dine?"
he questioned of the slim form and tired, though unwrinkled, face.
Sometime yesterday,"
Stephen said.
"Yesterday?"
exclaimed Bloom, till he remembered it was already tomorrow, Friday.
"Ah, you mean it's after 12.
The day before yesterday,"
Stephen said, improving on himself. Literally astounded at this piece of intelligence, Bloom reflected. Though they didn't see eye to eye in everything, a certain analogy there somehow was, as if both their minds were travelling, so to speak, in the one train of thought. At his age, when dabbling in politics roughly some score of years previously, when he had been a quasi-aspirant to parliamentary honours in the Buckshot Foster days, he too recollected, in retrospect, which was a source of keen satisfaction in itself, he had a sneaking regard for those same ultra-ideas. For instance, when the evicted tenants question, then at its first inception, bulked largely in people's minds, though, it goes without saying, not contributing a copper or pinning his faith absolutely to its dictums, some of which wouldn't exactly hold water, he, at the outset in principle, at all events, was in thorough sympathy with peasant possession, as voicing the trend of modern opinion, a partiality, however, which, realizing his mistake, he was subsequently partially cured of, and even was twitted with going a step further than Michael Davitt in the striking views he at one time inculcated as a back-to-the-lander, which was one reason he strongly resented the innuendo put upon him in so barefaced a fashion at the gathering of the clans in Barney Kiernan's, so that he, though often considerably misunderstood, and the least pugnacious of mortals, be it repeated, departed from his customary habit to give him, metaphorically, one in the gizzard. Though so far as politics themselves were concerned, he was only too conscious of the casualties invariably resulting from propaganda and displays of mutual animosity, and the misery and suffering it entailed as a foregone conclusion on fine young fellows chiefly, destruction of the fittest, in a word. Anyhow, upon weighing the pros and cons, getting on for one as it was high time to be retiring for the night. The crux was, it was a bit risky to bring him home, as eventualities might possibly ensue, somebody having a temper of her own sometimes, and spoil the hash altogether, as on the night he misguidedly brought home a dog, breed unknown, with a lame paw. Not that the cases were either identical or the reverse, though he had hurt his hand, too, to Ontario Terrace, as he very distinctly remembered, having been there, so to speak. On the other hand, it was altogether far and away too late for the Sandy Mount or Sandy Cove suggestion, so that he was in some perplexity as to which of the two alternatives. Everything pointed to the fact that it behoved him to avail himself to the full of the opportunity, all things considered. His initial impression was that he was a bit standoffish, or not over-effusive, but it grew on him some way. For one thing, he mightn't what you call jump at the idea if approached, and what mostly worried him was he didn't know how to lead up to it, or word it exactly, supposing he did entertain the proposal, as it would afford him very great personal pleasure if he would allow him to help to put coin in his way, or some wardrobe, if found suitable. At all events, he wound up by concluding, eschewing for the nonce, hide-bound precedent, a cup of Epsom cocoa and a shakedown for the night, plus the use of a rug or two and overcoat, doubled into a pillow. At least he would be in safe hands, and as warm as a toast on a trivet. He failed to perceive any very vast amount of harm in that, always with the proviso no rumpus of any sort was kicked up. A move had to be made, because that merry old soul, the grass widower in question, who appeared to be glued to the spot, didn't appear in any particular hurry to wend his way home to his dearly beloved Queenstown, and it was highly likely some sponger's bawdy house of retired beauties off Sheriff Street Lower would be the best clue to that equivocal character's whereabouts for a few days to come, alternately racking their feelings, the mermaids, with six-chamber revolver anecdotes verging on the tropical, calculated to freeze the marrow of anybody's bones, and mauling their large-sized charms between whiles with rough-and-tumble gusto to the accompaniment of large potations of potsheen and the usual blarney about himself. For as to who he in reality was, let XX equal my right name and address, as Mr. Algebra remarks, pass him. At the same time, he inwardly chuckled over his repartee to the blood-announced champion about his god being a Jew. People could put up with being bitten by a wolf, but what properly riled them was a bite from a sheep. The most vulnerable point, too, of tender Achilles, your god was a Jew, because mostly they appeared to imagine he came from Carrick-on-Shannon or somewhere about in the county Sligo.
I propose,
our hero eventually suggested, after mature reflection, while prudently pocketing her photo.
As it's rather stuffy here, you just come with me and talk things over. My diggings are quite close in the vicinity. You can't drink that stuff. Wait, I'll just pay this lot.
The best plan clearly being to clear out, the remainder being plain sailing, he beckoned, while prudently pocketing the photo, to the keeper of the shanty, who didn't seem to...
Yes, that's the best,
he assured Stephen, to whom, for the matter of that, Brazenhead, or him, or anywhere else, was all more or less... All kinds of utopian plans were flashing through his, Bloom's, busy brain. Education, the genuine article, literature, journalism, prize tidbits, up-to-date billing, hydros and concert tours in English watering resorts packed with theatres, turning money away, duets in Italian with the accent perfectly true to nature, and a quantity of other things. No necessity, of course, to tell the world and his wife from the housetops about it, and a slice of luck. An opening was always wanted, because he more than suspected he had his father's voice to bank his hopes on, which it was quite on the cards he had. So it would be just as well, by the way no harm, to trail the conversation in the direction of that particular red herring, just to... The cabbie read out of the paper he had got hold of that the former viceroy, Earl Cadogan, had presided at the Cab Drivers Association dinner in London somewhere. Silence with a yawn or two accompanied this thrilling announcement. Then the old specimen in the corner, who appeared to have some spark of vitality left, read out that Sir Anthony MacDonald had left Euston for the Chief Secretary's Lodge, or words to that effect, to which absorbing piece of intelligence... Echo answered why.
Give us a squint at that literature, grandfather,
the ancient mariner put in, manifesting some natural impatience.
And welcome,
answered the elderly party thus addressed. The sailor lugged out from a case he had a pair of greenish goggles, which he very slowly hooked over his nose and both ears.
Are you bad in the eyes?
The sympathetic personage, like the town clerk, queried.
Why,
answered the seafarer with the tartan beard, who seemingly was a bit of a literary cove in his own small way. staring out of sea-green portholes, as you might well describe them as.
I uses goggles reading. Sand in the Red Sea done that. One time I could read a book in the dark, manner of speaking. The Arabian Nights Entertainment was my favourite, and red as a rose is she.
Thereupon he pawed the journal open, and pored upon, Lord only knows what, Found Drowned, or The Exploits of King Willow, Ironmonger having made 100-something second wicket, not out, for knots, during which time, completely regardless of ire, the keeper was intensely occupied loosening an apparently new or second-hand boot, which manifestly pinched him, as he muttered against whoever it was sold it. All of them who were sufficiently awake enough to be picked out by their facial expressions, that is to say, either simply looking on glumly or passing a trivial remark. To cut a long story short, Bloom, grasping the situation, was the first to rise to his feet, so as not to outstay their welcome, having first and foremost, being as good as his word that he would foot the bill for the occasion, taken the wise precaution to unobtrusively motion to mine host as a parting shot, a scarcely perceptible sign when the others were not looking, to the effect that the amount due was forthcoming, making a grand total of 4p, the amount he deposited unobtrusively in 4 coppers, literally the last of the Mohicans. He having previously spotted on the printed price list for all who ran to read, opposite to him, in unmistakable figures, Coffee 2D, Confectionery D.O., and honestly well worth twice the money once in a way, as Weatherup used to remark.
Come,
he counselled, to close the seance. Seeing that the ruse worked and the coast was clear, they left the shelter or shanty together, and the elite society of Oilskin and Company, whom nothing short of an earthquake would move out of their dolce far niente. Stephen, who confessed to still feeling poorly and fagged out, paused at the, for a moment, the door to...
One thing I never understood,
he said, to be original on the spur of the moment.
Why they put tables upside down at night? I mean chairs upside down on the tables in cafes.
To which impromptu the never-failing Bloom replied without a moment's hesitation, saying straight off,
to sweep the floor in the morning.
So saying, he skipped around nimbly, considering, frankly, at the same time apologetic, to get on his companion's right, a habit of his, by the by, the right side being, in classical idiom, his tender Achilles. The night air was certainly now a treat to breathe, though Stephen was a bit weak on his pins.
It will, the air, do you good,
Bloom said, meaning also the walk, in a moment.
The only thing is to walk, then you'll feel a different man. It's not far. Lean on me.
Accordingly, he passed his left arm in Stephen's right, and led him on accordingly.
Yes,
Stephen said, uncertainly, because he thought he felt a strange kind of flesh of a different man approach him, sinuous and wobbly and all that. Anyhow, they passed the sentry box with stones, brazier, etc., where the municipal supernumerary, ex-Gumley, was still to all intents and purposes wrapped in the arms of Murphy, as the adage has it, dreaming of fresh fields and pastures new. And apropos of coffin of stones, the analogy was not at all bad, as it was, in fact, a stoning to death on the part of 72 out of 80-odd constituencies that ratted at the time of the split, and chiefly the belauded peasant class, probably the self-same evicted tenants he had put in their holdings. So they passed on to chatting about music, a form of art for which Bloom, as a pure amateur, possessed the greatest love, as they made tracks arm in arm across Beresford Place. Wagnerian music, though confessedly grand in its way, was a bit too heavy for Bloom, and hard to follow at the first go-off. But the music of Mercadante's Huguenots, Meyerbeer's 7 Last Words on the Cross, and Mozart's 12th Mass, he simply revelled in, the Gloria in that being to his mind the acme of first-class music as such, literally knocking everything else into a cocked hat. He infinitely preferred the sacred music of the Catholic Church to anything the opposite shop could offer in that line, such as those Moody and Sankey hymns, or Bid Me to Live and I Will Live Thy Protestant to Be. He also yielded to none in his admiration of Rossini's Stabat Mater, a work simply abounding in immortal numbers, in which his wife, Madame Marion Tweedy, made a hit, a veritable sensation, he might safely say, greatly adding to her other laurels, and putting the others totally in the shade, in the Jesuit Father's church in Upper Gardiner Street, the sacred edifice being thronged to the doors to hear her with virtuosos, or virtuosi, rather. There was the unanimous opinion that there was none to come up to her, and, suffice it to say, in a place of worship, for music of a sacred character, there was a generally voiced desire for an encore. On the whole, though favouring preferably light opera of the Don Giovanni description, and Marta, a gem in its line, he had a penchant, though with only a surface knowledge, for the severe classical school such as Mendelssohn. And talking of that, taking it for granted he knew all about the old favourites, he mentioned par excellence Lionel's air in Marta, Ma Paris, which, curiously enough, he heard, or overheard, to be more accurate, on yesterday, a privilege he keenly appreciated, from the lips of Stephen's respected father, sung to perfection, a study of the number, in fact, which made all the others take a back seat. Stephen, in reply to a politely put query, said he didn't, but launched out into praises of Shakespeare's songs, at least of, in or about that period, the lutenist Dowland, who lived in Fetter Lane, near Gerard the Herbalist, who, anno ludendo hausi Dowlandus, an instrument he was contemplating purchasing from Mr. Arnold Dolmetsch, whom Bloom did not quite recall, though the name certainly sounded familiar, for 65 guineas, and Farnaby and Son, with their ducks and cummies conceits, and Bird, William, who played the virginals, he said, in the Queen's Chapel, or anywhere else he found them, and one Tomkins, who made toys or airs, and John Bull. On the roadway which they were approaching, whilst still speaking, beyond the swing chain, a horse, dragging a sweeper, paced on the paven ground, brushing a long swathe of mire up, so that with the noise, Bloom was not perfectly certain whether he had caught aright the allusion to 65 guineas and John Bull. He inquired if it was John Bull the political celebrity of that ilk, as it struck him the two identical names as a striking coincidence. By the chains, the horse slowly swerved to turn, which perceiving, Bloom, who was keeping a sharp lookout as usual, plucked the other's sleeve gently, jocosely remarking,
"Our lives are in peril tonight. Beware of the steamroller."
They thereupon stopped. Bloom looked at the head of a horse not worth anything like 65 guineas, suddenly in evidence in the dark, quite near, so that it seemed new, a different grouping of bones and even flesh, because palpably it was a forewalker, a hip-shaker, a black buttocker, a tail-dangler, a head-hanger, putting his hind foot foremost, the while the lord of his creation sat on the perch, busy with his thoughts. But such a good, poor brute. He was sorry he hadn't a lump of sugar, but, as he wisely reflected, you could scarcely be prepared for every emergency that might crop up. He was just a big, foolish, nervous, noodly kind of a horse, without a second care in the world. But even a dog, he reflected, take that mongrel in Barney Kiernan's, of the same size, would be a holy horror to face. But it was no animal's fault in particular if he was built that way, like the camel, ship of the desert, distilling grapes into potsheen in his hump. 9/10 of them all could be caged or trained, nothing beyond the art of man, barring the bees. Whale with a harpoon hairpin, alligator, tickle the small of his back and he sees the joke, chalk a circle for a rooster, tiger, my eagle eye. These timely reflections, anent the brutes of the field, occupied his mind, somewhat distracted from Stephen's words, while the ship of the street was manoeuvring. And Stephen went on about the highly interesting old...
What's this I was saying? Ah, yes, my wife,
he intimated, plunging in medias res,
would have the greatest of pleasure in making your acquaintance, as she is passionately attached to music of any kind.
He looked sideways in a friendly fashion at the side face of Stephen, image of his mother, which was not quite the same as the usual blackguard type they unquestionably had an indubitable hankering after, as he was perhaps not that way built. Still, supposing he had his father's gift, as he more than suspected, it opened up new vistas in his mind, such as Lady Fingal's Irish Industries concert on the preceding Monday, and aristocracy in general. Exquisite variations he was now describing on an air, Youth Here Has End, by Jans Peter Sveelink, a Dutchman of Amsterdam, where the Frau's come from. Even more, he liked an old German song of Johannes Jeep about the clear sea and the voices of sirens, sweet murderers of men, which boggles Bloom a bit.
Von der serenen Listigkeit tun die Poeten dichten.
These opening bars he sang and translated extempore. Bloom, nodding, said he perfectly understood, and begged him to go on by all means, which he did. A phenomenally beautiful tenor voice like that, the rarest of boons, which Bloom appreciated at the very first note he got out, could easily, if properly handled by some recognized authority on voice production, such as Barraclough, and being able to read music into the bargain, command its own price, where baritones were 10 a penny, and procure for its fortunate possessor, in the near future, an entree into fashionable houses in the best residential quarters, of financial magnates in a large way of business, and titled people, where, with his university degree of B.A., a huge ad in its way, and gentlemanly bearing to all, the more influenced the good impression, he would infallibly score a distinct success, being blessed with brains, which also could be utilized for the purpose, and other requisites, if his clothes were properly attended to, so as to the better worm his way into their good graces, as he, a youthful tyro in society's sartorial niceties, hardly understood how a little thing like that could militate against you. It was, in fact, only a matter of months, and he could easily foresee him participating in their musical and artistic conversaziones during the festivities of the Christmas season for choice, causing a slight flutter in the dovecotes of the fair sex, and being made a lot of by ladies out for sensation, cases of which, as he happened to know, were on record. In fact, without giving the show away, he himself once upon a time, if he cared to, could easily have. Added to which, of course, would be the pecuniary emolument, by no means to be sneezed at, going hand in hand with his tuition fees. Not, he parenthesized, that for the sake of filthy lucre he need necessarily embrace the lyric platform as a walk in life for any lengthy space of time, but a step in the required direction it was, beyond yea or nay, and both monetarily and mentally it contained no reflection on his dignity in the smallest, and it often turned in uncommonly handy to be handed a check at a much-needed moment when every little helped. Besides, though taste latterly had deteriorated to a degree, original music like that, different from the conventional rot, would rapidly have a great vogue, as it would be a decided novelty for Dublin's musical world after the usual hackneyed run of catchy tenor solos foisted on a confiding public by Ivan St. Austell and Hilton St. Just and their genus omne. Yes, beyond a shadow of a doubt, he could, with all the cards in his hand, and he had a capital opening, to make a name for himself and win a high place in the city's esteem, where he could command a stiff figure and, booking ahead, give a grand concert for the patrons of the King Street House, given a backer-up, if one were forthcoming to kick him upstairs, so to speak, a big if, however, with some impetus of the go-ahead sort to obviate the inevitable procrastination which often tripped up a too-much-fated prince of good fellows, and it need not detract from the other by one iota, as, being his own master, he would have heaps of time to practice literature in his spare moments, when desirous of so doing, without its clashing with his vocal career, or containing anything derogatory whatsoever, as it was a matter for himself alone. In fact, he had the ball at his feet, and that was the very reason why the other, possessed of a remarkably sharp nose for smelling a rat of any sort, hung on to him at all. The horse was just then, and later on, at a propitious opportunity, he purposed, Bloom did, without anyway prying into his private affairs, on the fool's step in where angels principle, advising him to sever his connection with a certain budding practitioner, who, he noticed, was prone to disparage and even, to a slight extent, with some hilarious pretext, when not present, deprecate him, or whatever you like to call it, which, in Bloom's humble opinion, threw a nasty sidelight on that side of a person's character. No pun intended. The horse, having reached the end of his tether, so to speak, halted, and rearing high a proud, feathering tail, added his quota by letting fall on the floor, which the brush would soon brush up and polish, three smoking globes of turds. Slowly, three times, one after another, from a full crupper, he mired. And humanely his driver waited till he, or she, had ended, patient in his scythed car. Side by side, Bloom, profiting by the contretemps, with Stephen passed through the gap of the chains, divided by the upright, and stepping over a strand of mire, went across towards Gardiner Street Lower, Stephen singing more boldly, but not loudly, the end of the ballad.
Und alle Schiffe brücken.
The driver never said a word, good, bad, or indifferent. He merely watched the two figures as he sat on his low-backed car, both black, one full, one lean, walked towards the railway bridge, to be married by Father Marr. As they walked, they at times stopped and walked again, continuing their tete-a-tete, which of course he was utterly out of, about sirens, enemies of man's reason, mingled with a number of other topics of the same category, usurpers, historical cases of the kind, while the man in the sweeper car, or you might as well call it the sleeper car, who in any case couldn't possibly hear because they were too far, simply sat in his seat near the end of Lower Gardiner Street and looked after their low-backed car.